Hello, and welcome to the next episode of Transperfect Lifestyle Talks. I'm Mark Wade, I'm the practice leader here at Transperfect, and today I'm delighted to introduce Nikki Bush, Executive Director and Global Health of Endpoint Strategy at COA at Open Health. You've been in this for quite a while, so I mean, you're ex-Lilly, you're ex-J&J, same as me, you've been around for a while, so it's great to see you. Thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks for letting everyone know how old I am. Appreciate that. Oh.
well, hold on, I'm older than you, so there you go. Look, there you go. Anyway, thanks for coming on. You and I talked about the PFDD
guidance series.
Yeah. Guidance. And when we talked about it, it wasn't published. But recently, you were at an FDA workshop. And I was wondering if you'd maybe tell the audience what your findings were. Because that's literally hot off the press, isn't it?
Well, yeah. So we had a workshop just a week ago today, actually, FDA held a workshop. And it wasn't just on the PFDD guidance. It was on patient experience data overall and talking about what it is, how we can use it, how it can be part of a submission. And then we dove into some methodological issues around, you know, norming data, et cetera. They have the recording up if anybody's interested in checking out what was said. But it was really, I think it was really helpful to walk through how FDA views patient experience data and the importance of explaining to the FDA what data you collected and how you expect those data to be a part of your application or part of your interaction. Because there's been a lot of just submitting patient data, I think, to agencies without a lot of direction or saying, this is what we think it means. This is what we think, what role we think it could play in benefit risk evaluation, et cetera.
So it's just data without the interpretation, as it were.
Yeah. No interpretation or no indication of where in the application it might be relevant even. So the data could be great, but without the right operational piece to say this is how it fits in to the rest of the story, it's not as valuable, not as useful as it could be.
Interesting. Does that speak to the protocol design? Does that speak to the study design? Or is that just the way we've always done it? I'm genuinely curious.
Maybe it's the way we've always done it, but I think it's also, you know, with patient-focused drug development, there's always been interest in patient experience data, but this real push to get different kinds of data. So maybe it's a natural history study or maybe the in-trial interview. So you have this qualitative data, or maybe you're doing a standalone qualitative study. So the types of data coming in to the agency or going to a reviewer or a regulatory body or even a health authority or HTA body, there it's just more varied now. It's not just clinical trial data where you have phase 1, 2, 3, you put your data in, they review it, and that's it. So we have to be a lot more mindful about how we're putting the story together with so many different types of data going in and so such a high volume and wanting reviews to be facilitated and efficient as possible. So kind of saying, not only here's a bunch of data, but we think it's helpful to interpret these endpoints, or we think it would be helpful to understand the natural history, or we think this piece really is evidence of unmet treatment need or unmet clinical need. So having to, and sometimes the data are going to be for more than one use. You know, we'll put it in a COA dossier, a lot of concept elicitation data to support content validity of an instrument that might support an endpoint, but that doesn't mean that concept elicitation data aren't also going to point to the unmet treatment need as well, or the patient experience of previous treatment. So it's just highlighting what those data are and how they're intended to be used in decision-making.
You said a couple of things that were very interesting, but the amount of data is enormous. And this goes back to my bugbear, which is how we have in a protocol, we have so many different instruments because we have so many different stakeholders. They want to capture different patient voices. And as we put more instruments in the protocol, we're putting more burden on the patients. My question is, my question is like, what's the holy grail? What's the balance there, you know?
That is hitting the nail on the head. I think we struggle with that a lot with all of the stakeholders and then trying to be as efficient and as quick as the science allows, right? So we don't want to move anything to market that's not safe, but we do want to move things along. I think the issue with the volumes of data are not around getting different perspectives, because you do need a care partner's perspective and then the perspective of the patient. We also want this perspective of the clinician. I think it gets really difficult when different reviewer bodies, whether they be, you know, HTA or access related or regulatory, they have a desire for specific instruments, right? They'll consider a specific version of a specific instrument fit for purpose. I don't get as bothered if I have four questionnaires that are really relevant to the patient. And patients have said this as well. As long as it's a question that's relevant and I feel like I'm being heard, I don't mind completing it. But if I feel like I'm filling out the same questionaire just in three different versions, that's really frustrating. And if you, you know, I always sit down and go through the actual clinical trial, go through a clinical visit and pull out every question in order that patients are going to answer. And between different versions of an instrument or different types of instruments, and then we have anchors in there to help us interpret endpoints. Sometimes you're asking the same question with slight variations on a theme, maybe seven times in a visit. And it is frustrating for everybody.
It is. That frustration, coupled with the sheer length sometimes of the instrument, coupled with the frequency. Sometimes I wonder, what kind of data are we getting from the patients? Is it good data or is it, I'm just answering this just to finish this process? We saw that 20 years ago, we saw that with IVRS, where after five questions, patients were just pushing buttons because they were so frustrated. And this is a tiny bit throwback to that, isn't it, in many ways?
Yeah, I mean, it is. And I think, you know, IVRS is a little different, but I think it's not as simple as volume. You know, are there too many items? Are there too many questions? Are there too many tasks to do? I think it really boils down to relevance. Do I feel as a participant in a trial that you're asking me about what's important because I'm helping, right? I mean, because all clinical trial participants are really giving a lot of their time and energy into kind of the hope of the future, right? So if it's important enough of a question and it's really relevant to their experience, well, that's time that we can spend. But if it's just, it feels like a checkbox exercise, or if it feels like it's not even relevant, you know, if I'm asking about your hair falling out and it's not even a chemotherapy treatment, then it's like, why am I doing this? And, you know, then the patient feels invisible.
Yeah,
and
I totally agree with you. I'll think like it depends also on the disease state, because certain disease states have much, you know, oncology studies, we're asking an awful lot from these patients. Mm-hmm. If we're asking them to fill out a questionnaire before treatment or after treatment, their lethargy is very, very different. So, I think we also have to take into account the TA, the disease state that we're measuring. There are certain patients, and MS is a great example, where the patients are incredibly motivated, and we find that their participation is almost overzealous in many ways. It's wonderful, you know, but we have to take into account that the disease state that we're measuring as well, not just the redundant. Asking the same question. Yeah. What did you call it? The variance on a theme?
Yeah, variation on a theme.
Absolutely. Yeah. We got to get away from that.
I do want to go back to that point, though, because we have the disease state or the indication therapeutic area. It does really matter, even when the data are important. If you take migraine, for instance, giving someone a handheld device or bring your own device instrument on migraine and having this bright screen in their face the minute they have a migraine headache and then asking them to answer a bunch of questions doesn't work. I mean, so you do have to think about how is it going to be operationalized and how is this really going to work?
That pivots right to the next point, which I, by the way, I totally agree with you. And I think that's all about planning. But I think in many ways, I'm going to be shot for saying this, but I think in many ways, we are so focused on the technology of delivering these instruments that we've kind of, in a way, got away from the science of it. Why are we doing this? What scientifically are we measuring? And I feel sometimes that we've moved just slightly towards the operational piece and away from science. And I don't know how you feel about that.
I mean, I think sometimes it's a little more than slightly, but it is. I mean, how many times have anyone in my position been called, you know, I'm locking a protocol in 2 weeks, what instruments should I put in? Or, you know, what instruments should I translate ahead of time so that we have them ready to put in a trial without any discussion of what's the trial design, what are the trial objectives? So when you think about science, it doesn't make any sense. But the focus is get this piece done and move it forward.
It's very frustrating. And people like you should be at the start of the study design, because you're going to be looking at what is measured, how it's measured, how we're going to measure that with that patient cohort. So it's people like you should be further up the food chain. People like me are, like, unfortunately brought in, the translation piece were brought in when it might be a bit late, because they're saying we need those translations and our FPI is July the 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, what's the geography of all these kind of things? So it's very, very frustrating.
Well, I think part of the issue, you know, we've talked about this before, is that it used to be that when we're collecting data on, you know, with paper and pen, you could have a group who designs a clinical trial, and then you kind of toss it over the fence to an operational group who can make it happen. And sometimes we still try to operate that way, but the people in the room who are designing a clinical trial don't always understand the implication of the decisions they're making. Like, how long does it take to translate and back translate and get a solid translation? How long does it take to program if you want data collected electronically? And without an understanding of what that looks like, there is a lot of frustration and misunderstanding of why does this take so long, and why a lot of pointing of fingers. But what it boils down to is we don't always have the right people in the room at the beginning who can say, let's make the most informed decisions possible. Like, yes, we can go this, but here's what it's going to take from a time.
In many ways, we want one person in the room who will say, just stop there for 1 second. Just stop for 1 second, and let's get a bunch of people in who know about this. And
yeah,
all you need is one voice to stop the train from hurtling down the tracks.
Yes.
That's all around the study design. To me, that speaks to training. To me, that speaks to awareness and training.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a bugbear for us in the translation world. That's a real bugbear, because, as you rightly say, people say, why does it take so many weeks to do a validated translation? And you have to explain what it does take that long. I can't change the laws of physics. What can we do vis-a-vis training? What can we do to get study leaders aware of all the moving parts, or can we?
I think we can. I mean, part of the issue is, again, I mean, you've already mentioned kind of how complicated trials have gotten, and we've gotten away from really thinking holistically about what we're doing sometimes with a study. But I think from a training perspective, it's very easy to understand why you need a clinician in the room, why you need a clinical trialist or scientist in the room, why you need a statistician. No one has ever called me and was like, hey, I need a measurement scientist. Like, I need to make sure the psychometrics, no one has ever said that. No one thinks about measurement science as a capability. And so it doesn't occur if it's a clinical outcome assessment and the FDA is interested in it, then anybody would say, I need a clinician in the room and I need my regulatory scientist in the room, because it involves clinical outcome assessment and it involves FDA, right? And so we want to be efficient and just get the right people. The problem is you still need that COA measurement scientist, and there's not enough awareness of that is a capability in and of itself. Part of that is we talk to each other about what we should be doing, and we talk to the people at the FDA and the EMA and the PMDA about what we should be doing, but it doesn't always leave our group. And so, you know, I think we need to be, FDA could go to DIA, to other, and say, this is a capability. You need to have this understanding. But even if they do that, they can't point to the people in the company. You know, they're not going to say, hey, you need to call Nikki. That's just not going to happen.
It's not, but maybe it should happen. Seriously, it should. Like I said, there needs to be one voice in the room. There seems to be a lack of consistency around the actual design phase. They don't forget the COA scientist piece, but they often aren't aware of it. How do we bring that up further in awareness? How do we do that?
Well, you know, part of it is, we think about 2006 and 2009, right? We had the draft PRO guidance and the final PRO guidance. Very exciting time, right? Champagne and woohoo, finalized it. We're all going to be good now.
We're showing our age, by the way, Nikki. Stop it.
I know. Okay.
I read about it. I wasn't involved. I read about it. Go ahead.
We didn't do ourselves any favors by saying PROs, patient reported outcome instruments, are really special, right? We made them, and it wasn't just us, but it was kind of like this other thing. and it was special and it was important. Now, I think we did that for a reason, because we wanted to explain the importance of what we were doing, but it did make it seem like this whole other thing. And then those endpoints that are related to patient reported outcomes, kind of sometimes even in a protocol, they got just pushed to their own section. So it just became an other and not really almost an attachment to a clinical trial as opposed to an integrated part of the design. And then as FDA and EMA and others have said, okay, well, we're going to apply this to all clinical outcome assessments, not just patient reported. So observer reported, clinician reported, performance outcome assessments. We're going to look at these same measurement properties, same evidence that it's fit for purpose, use the PRO guidance. Well, then it became, okay, well, I guess all of these other endpoints, maybe they're related, or maybe this team works on those. But if it's a primary endpoint, and it's a clinical outcome assessment, there was still a separation, right? Because it was the clinical team owned that, or the statisticians owned that. And it wasn't, there was just no meeting of the minds and there was no understanding. So many times I've had teams come to me, clinical teams, and say, can you come in and give us sort of a primer on measurement and clinical outcome assessments? And they're like, oh, we just don't understand it. I'm like, how? It's an endpoint, you know? I mean, it's data that you collect in order to measure something that's in your objectives, and then you have to analyze the data. It can't be separated from the rest of the clinical trial, but it still is somehow, and it's seen in the outcome or something different.
That was with paper. Now, you know, confound that with the electronic modalities that we have.
Yeah.
Whereas you said, you had a great point earlier on when you said you just throw it over the wall with paper, but now we have to build in the build for the electronic device, we to build in the translations into that, because as you well know, languages change the dynamic of the screen massively. And then we have screenshot reviews that the notifying bodies want to see and all that good stuff. And it's become a much bigger thing. So my question is, I suppose, how do we get farther into the decision-making process? How do we get the study designers to say, okay, we are going to use COAs. We are going to use these as our endpoints. How are we going to capture them? How are we going to do this? How do we get that conversation going? Because you and I have been doing this for a long time and we're still having the same conversations that we were having years ago.
Yeah.
Anything, can anything change? What is the Holy Grail?
Yeah. When I've seen it work well, it's when, and again, it's when you have the right people in the room early. And, you know, historically, some of those people might be seen as more clinical operations. And so there's not always that sort of intuitive feeling of like, oh, I need to bring them in really early to study design because they're operational. And that piece, we're not on that piece yet. But now that piece matters more and more and more. And they have to be part of the study design because all of the data collection is impacted. Now we have wearables and sensors as well. And I think there's this sense in some pockets of industry where this is going to solve all of the problems, because now we're just going to passively collect all of this data and this huge volume of data will come in, but without a thought of, well, what is it that, again, study design, what is it that we're measuring? How are we going to interpret those data? And what does it really mean? And there is comfort. They're like, oh, it's more objective and it's not, and which makes my skin crawl. But the thing is, we validate those wearables and sensors against a clinical outcome assessment because it's an indirect assessment, right, of something. Mm-hmm. So we still need a clinical outcome assessment in order to interpret whatever this high volume of data is telling us. So we're only ever as good as the clinical outcome assessment that we have. And that's why we have points that aren't good enough. So I don't.
You're preaching to the choir, because that goes exactly back to what you said at the top of this conversation around the interpretation. And now we have this huge data set now coming in from the wearables. Yeah. And if no one is going to be there to interpret it, and we don't have a proper data science COA person doing it, I think that data is lost. I think you're now ticking a box. You're actually not doing anything. You're just ticking a box.
Yeah. Everyone thinks it's so cool because there are these cool gadgets and whatever. And it must be better because it's this huge volume of data but then we just aggregate it and look at it at the week level or whatever, because that's the only thing we know how to do. And then it's, well, then why didn't we just measure it over a week? Like, why are we like going down to this? You know, the more precise you get with your measurement, the more important the interpretation is. Like, just because you can measure something at that level doesn't mean it means anything. And so we have to do that work too. So
yeah, I think that's the takeaway from this conversation.
Yeah.
Without the interpretation, this huge data sets, it's worthless.
Yeah, completely.
We're just measuring for the sake of measuring.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Nikki, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Today I was talking to Nikki Bush. She's the Executive Director and Global Head Endpoint Solutions at Open Health. I hope you enjoyed it. Please subscribe to the podcast or ping me directly, mwade@transperfect.com. Until next time, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.